Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between what's going on with our health and what's going on with our greater environment, what's going on with our communities, with our society, with our policies, with our food, water, air, and earth, and with the fate of the earth. So every week on this program, we talk about that. Also, as a longstanding journalist of the integrative health movement, I'm also always delving into health and fascinated by new areas of discovery and knowledge. You know, we've done past programs talking about the microbiome, and, you know, health is always kind of expanding in our understanding and in its realm of possibility. So there's a lot of science, new science, and new ways of thinking about health that we very much like to cover on this program, and that just totally fascinates me personally as someone who's done a lot of science reporting. This week, I'm really delighted to have on the show Dr. Norman Doidge, and I was a big fan of his first book, The Brain That Changes Itself, which was published in 2007. He now has a new book, The Brain's Way of Healing. This is a very important topic to understand, and he's really been a pioneer in reporting on it and making it accessible to people, because we have a lot of fixed ideas about what health potentials we really have, or, you know, narrow understanding of what constitutes science, and really the direction that the most exciting new science is taking is really to expand and show us so many possibilities that never seemed to be there before. So I'm really delighted to have him on the show to discuss his book and the idea of brain plasticity, which underlies both his books. Norman Doidge is a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, and the New York Times bestselling author of The Brain That Changes Itself. And he's on the research faculty of the Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research at Columbia University's Department of Psychiatry in New York City, and he is also on the faculty of the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry. Actually, my late and beloved uncle was at the Columbia University's Psychoanalytic
David
Institute.
David Levy? Was it David Levy?
No, Sidney Cohen, his name was.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I have a special love for that as a, you know, research institute. So in any case, that's just a personal aside. In any case, I'm really, really happy to welcome you to Connect
the Dots. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So let's talk. In your first book, you talked about these, you know, this new research and understanding about neuroplasticity, how the brain, how the nervous system could change itself. In the new book, you're talking about how this is being put into practice at the frontiers of medicine. So let's begin by, if you would be so kind, as to define for our listeners, what is neuroplasticity?
Sure. Neuro is for neuron, the nerve cells in the brain. The neurons aren't the only nerve cells in the brain, but they're the ones that fire off electrical signals. And plasticity just means changeable, modifiable, adaptable. And neuroplasticity is that property of the brain, and this is where it becomes holistic, that allows it to change its structure and its function in response to mental experience and activity. So thought, what you think, what you imagine, what you do, including how you move your body, but also how you think, all can change brain structure and function. And this has been shown now in thousands of experiments in animals and human beings. It's just mainstream neuroscience at this point. But it's only fairly recent that it's become mainstream. And this means that people who have been trained clinically in the period before it became mainstream in neuroscience were trained in models of the brain that didn't think it could change its structure and function at all, not to mention through mental experience, which is itself, you know, fantastic. And for about 100 years, at least, the mainstream view And there were some dissenters, I understand, but the mainstream view was that the brain was fixed and its circuitry was formed and finalized in childhood. And it was seen like a machine with parts, and each part performed a single mental function in a single location in the brain. And the circuitry was seen to be hardwired. And so the only change that the brain underwent was the change that aging hardware undergoes, which is to degenerate. It wears out. The idea that activity might actually help you mold, sculpt the brain, and actually improve it and maintain it was very far from that model. And so when people have brain problems and they come to practitioners who are locked in that model, they're often told, if they've had various kinds of brain problems and diseases, that by definition there's nothing that can be done. Now, I'm not saying that everybody can be helped all the time. What I'm saying is, by definition, it's not the case the brain is hardwired, and I illustrate examples where it can be, neuroplasticity can be recruited to bring or back or restore lost functions.
That's fascinating. You know, this is the most amazing example of where seeing human potential, you know, within a purely mechanical realm, you know, where one particular mechanism produces one particular effect and only that effect, which is really, you know, kind of rife in a great deal of our medical outlook, is it really doesn't capture the full potential. But what I love about this is that it not only relates to, there seems to be in this particular area a connection between what we, you know, what we call and how we view objective science and what we experience subjectively. And it's not that it's a connection that is, you know, religious or, or, you know, requires a belief system of any kind, but it shows how belief systems, even in what we view as an objective, you know, structure in science, you know, themselves need to be altered, and not because, and not just by a matter of faith, but as a matter, you know, or belief. I know that what I experience is X, Y, or Z, or I have faith that, you know, my particular experiences have as much validity, which, you know, on one level, on a subjective level, they certainly do. But on the other hand, this shows that in science there are these ways that, that, you know, that really can demonstrate the potential. And I find that such a huge breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that, of course, so many people can be helped.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that I'm interested in these recoveries, which weren't supposed to happen, in part to help people, for sure, in huge part, but I also do think that they have major philosophical implications in how we understand the relationship of mind and brain. And so we're on the same page about that. You know, basically, with the rise of modern science, the view of nature became very mechanistic. You know, Galileo showed that the planets move around and that they're, you know, moved around by forces and that they're inanimate, and people began to see that the universe seemed to be organized but like one big cosmic clock or mechanism. That's how they spoke. And this machine metaphor for the universe was applied historically to human beings and the organs inside, and we speak about, in, you know, medicine about mechanisms. We use the same language, and so on. And this is all left out mind, and we don't understand the extent to which mind is involved. The basic model, the machine metaphor of the brain gives, is that mind is an emergent property out of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
But we can never really explain how that happens. Neuroscientists will frequently say, you know, well, your thinking is going on inside your neurons, but they can't. In fact, nobody alive knows what that sentence means. Does it mean in one neuron, and if so, where? Between the neurons, in the connections between the neurons, in groups of neurons, or in the patterns of firing of neurons? Truth be told, honesty demands we confess that we don't exactly know where in the neurons that it goes on. But nonetheless, we're at the point now, and this is the burden of the second book, of really revisiting the fundamental concept of whether the brain can ever be healed. You know, for about 100 years, you can't find people using the word healing and brain in the same sentence very often, mm-hmm. because A, the brain was seen to be like a machine. B, people seem to have very bad prognoses for brain problems. But what I show in the first book and now much more in the second is often these poor prognoses happen because we were treating the brain as though it were inanimate and passive and that activity wears it out. And what I show in this book is activity is certain kinds of stimulation are fundamental for people who have brain problems. You have to know how to do it, when to do it, how much is required. But what happens, I propose a model of what happens in the brain when it's afflicted with damage or illness. And this applies to many, many, many brain problems. And if I could just take a moment on that, you'll understand Please. Why people can often do better than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
The first book talked about something called learned non-use, which was discovered by Edward Taub. When a person had a stroke, it had been known for 100 years that what happens in the brain is there's a chemical chaos and metabolic derangement. You know, there's blood from the stroke, clots have to be reabsorbed, etc. There's inflammation. And for about a period of 6 weeks, the brain is very, very busy dealing with the damage. And if a person tries to use their brain, do something, certain areas that are blown out by the stroke won't work, but the damage is much more global because of this crisis of the first six weeks. And if they try to do something in that 6 weeks, what happens, Taub showed, is they actually learn that they can't do it.
Oh.
And the circuits start to shut down. So that's the first concept. And he developed treatments for strokes where he could bring people back years after a stroke. If a person lost the use of, let's say, of their right hand, they would tend to use their left hand all the time after the stroke. And Taub would actually take the good hand, the left hand, put it in a cast, and force them to use the weakened hand
uh-huh.
and bring it back. What I've found is that this learned non-use occurs not only in stroke, but in many, many brain problems. So that whenever we see someone, we cannot assume that they're only as good as their current functioning. The second major point...
Very powerful.
Mm-hmm. ...is... I believe that the view that we've had of the brain has been far too digital, far too material, far too chemical, and far too digital. Here's what I mean by that. We focus very, very much on the stuff of the brain, which is largely, you know, we focused because of the way science is at the moment on chemicals in the brain. But we've known for a long time that the brain has two languages. It has the language of chemical signaling that is in, you know, every depression commercial. You have a problem with serotonin, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But those chemical issues tend in the brain to be very local. You know, dopamine, which we hear a lot about, is spread out through the brain, but it's very important in certain areas. But there is another language of the brain, which is the language of electrical signaling, and that is the lingua franca of the brain, that is spoken throughout the brain, across vast expanses of brain real estate. All the cells speak this language. And what is this language? It's not a material language. It's not a chemical language. It's a language of patterns of energy. And I also said that our model is too digital. Here's what I mean by that. When people study science, they're taught that neurons are either on or off. They're firing or they're not firing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not quite how it works. At a certain point, they sum up input and then they give off a spike. But if you look at it at the level of spikes, neurons are not spiking only in one situation, and that's when they're dead. When they're alive and in the so-called off position, they're occasionally giving off a spike. And then when they're in the on position, usually they start to give off spikes, electrical signals, much more rapidly. Sometimes that's reversed. So the model I have, and this is based on lots of work in neurofeedback, which is studies the electrical firing of the brain, is that when there is brain damage, it's not just that there's cells that are dead and cells that are alive. The brain is much more like the heart because it's always sending signals. So when there's brain damage, you've got the dead cells, which are giving no signals. You have the cells adjacent to the dead cells that were getting signals from the dead cells, and they're suddenly, no one's talking to them, and that messes them up. Then you have sick cells that are beside those cells, which are firing at unusual rates. And this has been shown by lots and lots of scientific studies to be very typical in a number of disorders, brain damage, epilepsy, aspects of Parkinson's, aspects of depression, learning disorders. Cells are often firing at an unusual rate. Then you have the healthy cells that are getting all these messed up signals. So all of these cells are getting, the dead cells are out of it. They have nothing to worry about. But all the other cells are getting unusual signals. You then may have some healthy cells, of course, which are getting normal signals. So the interventions in this new book often involve non-invasive ways of resynchronizing the brain, and it describes some very, very radical and sometimes very quick recoveries that come when you use energy. Energy is defined in Western terms to resynchronize the brain, and suddenly you discover that the person does not have as many dead cells as we feared. In fact, we even know that this is true in children who are born premature. We used to think that if they had an absence of function, that it was simply because, you know, if they had oxygen deprivation, you know, in utero, for instance, it was just all dead cells. But now some recent studies by Dean have shown that, in fact, this oxygen deprivation often just leads to poor connections between cells.
So this is almost like, I mean, what you're saying, I mean, what makes me think that the brain is almost like a community, an interactive community.
Yes.
Where, different parts of it may be stronger, weaker, out of it, high-functioning, kind of implicated in other low-functioning areas. I mean, it's an entirely different view.
Yes, it is. And it's, when I say it's not a material brain, what I in the book I discuss that, you know, people tend to think it's, quote, in the neurons. But I think that it's not, that hasn't been proven. And I think one of the reasons that the brain can reorganize when there's a problem is that what we're interested in the brain, in the brain is not just the neurons themselves, but the activity of the neurons. So if the neurons are firing patterns of energy, think of an orchestra that has a musical score. The patterns of energy are the musical score, and all the neurons are like the members of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. We've been so focused on the fact that some of the members didn't show up.
Uh-huh.
But you can sometimes just recruit other neurons nearby from that community of musicians,
right,
to take over and play that part of the score. And Allison, you and I, we're more our score than we are our neurons, I would submit, because if you think about it, you know, neurons are, I mean, there's different kinds of neurons in the brain, but neurons across species are in some respects are very similar, which is why we can learn a lot from other species. But what defines you and your experience and me and my experience is not just the neurons and their genetics, but the score that they play, which is our memories and skills. And those can be taken over by other neurons. And there's one other, I guess, key point to the book, and then we could just talk about whatever you want in terms of some of the cures, but it's this, that what I show in the book is that it's only in anatomy textbooks that the brain is separate from the body and the world. This is along your community and integration theme. In function, it just cannot exist without the peripheral nervous system and without, you know, the senses. And what are the senses? The sense receptors like the retina, the cochlea in the ear, the heat receptors, they are, in engineering terms, what's called a transducer. They turn patterns of energy in one form to another form of energy with all the information contained in the pattern. So if you're listening to music, your cochlea turns those sound waves, which are patterns of energy containing information, into electrical waves. And the retina and the eye does the same with light. And since the brain is neuroplastic, which I try to articulate for people to understand easily in the first book, you can, by changing the patterns of energy coming into the brain through the senses in a totally non-invasive way, also restructure the structure of the circuitry in the brain and its functioning. And so, you know, in my travels to investigate all of this, I saw examples of low-intensity lights shone on the back of the neck and the head to help a woman with brain injury, children with ADD go off medication and have their ADD cured with vibration, which was addressing brain circuitry. These avenues are very powerful. Sound therapy for the treatment of autism, and I can explain all of these, and even movement to help a girl who was born missing a third of her brain. I realize that these things, for people who don't accept that the brain is plastic and haven't fully integrated the extent to which the main language of the brain is patterns of energy, I realize they may sound difficult to believe, but the burden of this book, The Brain's Way of Healing, is to show that there are these non-invasive ways that can help some people, not everybody all the time, nothing does that, that have not been able, some people who have not been helped by other techniques. You don't have to split a skull open always to help people with very significant brain problems. If they have a bleed in their brain, you need a neurosurgeon to do that. But for many of these chronic conditions, it's not always necessary.
So what you're actually saying is that using the other reaches of the neurological system, the senses, movement, you know, the extended system can be recruited in certain specific ways to reorganize the patterning and help restore the overall pattern despite a material injury of one kind or another.
Yes, that's right. To restore the pattern and to get other cells that are still alive to take over the functions of the damaged cells. Yes.
So that, in fact, there is a learning process that can happen. But because it sounds also like because it's happening in electrical circuitry, in other words, if someone said, okay, take this chemical, take 5-HTP, and then, you know, you're deficient in that, and that will help the cell rebuild, you know. If somebody said that, there might be those who said, well, poo-poo, but there might be others who said, oh, well, I understand how supplementing or taking a chemical or a drug or anything, you know, would have an effect. But part of, it seems, the reason why this is hard for people to grasp is that we're so wired into the chemical explanation and we're not really used to thinking of the energy electrical
right. And, you know, basically there was a lot of interest after the discovery of electricity. And, you know, the work of Faraday and others in electromagnetism in the 1850s, there were a lot of attempts to use electricity in medicine, and Some of them were legit and some of them weren't. And there was a kind of a backlash against that. And, you know, medical doctors don't spend a lot of time studying physics. Some medical schools, you don't even need anything beyond high school physics to do it, at least in Canada. And it's just not a subject that came up very much in clinical medicine. But interestingly, the lab tests, the scanners, you know, the fMRIs, they all completely rely on energy. In fact, someone says, it's almost amusing to me when people think these things are far-fetched. They say, well, I want to see it on a brain scan. Well, what do you think a brain scan is? It's not a slice of brain. You know, an MRI involves, these various things. Some of them involve radioactivity, so, you know, some of them involve magnetism, et cetera. We're all very comfortable using energy-based interventions, or x-rays, for instance, to understand and see the human body. But what we failed to see, I would say, in recent years is the extent to which the human body is an energetic system. In fact, you know, electricity was, you know, it's not as though electricity was discovered in some lab with lots of transistors and batteries and metal. Electricity was first discovered in animals, animal electricity experiments. You know, people using eels for headaches and migraines in the ancient world, and then understanding that, you know, frogs and so on, you know, leapt with because of electrical impulses. The first studies of electricity in batteries came out of animal studies, and then we learned how to make things like batteries and transistors. It came out of living forms. But, you know, with the rise of, for instance, antibiotics, which were, you know, infectious diseases were incredibly important at the turn not of this past century, but the century before, and utterly devastating. And, you know, with the discovery of penicillin, et cetera, medicine moved from an art that used whatever was required to help the patient to more, you know, a physician used whatever was required to help the patient to more and more relying on, you know, medication or surgery. And a lot of other things seemed to gradually become far-fetched. Now, the whole world is using electricity constantly. I'm speaking to you on a telephone, which is patterns of information coming. I mean, patterns of information in my brain are changed to patterns of sound vibration in my voice. That's a transducer. My voice is a kind of changing pattern, one form of energy to another, which goes into the microphone, which changes the sound waves back to electrical, which then is passed to you, and so on and so forth. I mean, these transformations of energy are everywhere around us. And when people are skeptical of these things, I mean, you know, they get on a phone and say, I just heard the most ridiculous lecture or the ridiculous talk by Norman Doidge on the radio talking about how energy is important. And he's using his cell phone, you know, which is, and his car is driving at 70 miles an hour, and he's talking to his partner who's in another car that's driving 70 miles an hour in another direction, and perfectly willing to accept that patterns of information can be carried by energy. Except then when it comes to patients, it all of a sudden just seems flaky. Now, so I do want to say, look, there originally, I mean, I can say this in part because I've made the error. I mean, I originally remember at times patients talking to me about various holistic things before I'd looked into it, and they would use energy, and I would try to get them to define what the energy was, and they really couldn't. Was it electrical energy? Was it magnetic energy? And I wasn't wholly dismissive, but I just didn't really know what they were talking about. But I can say that in this book, what I've done is the energy interventions that are used all have equations that you can you can get from Western physics and understand. But the other thing that happened was, it wasn't lost on me or any of the neuroscientists that I or clinicians that I was working with, that you know, traditional, you know, Eastern medicine has always been talking about energy and the mind, not in ways that we can easily define in the West. And there may be subtle energies produced by the body that we cannot measure. But all of these neuroscientists and clinicians, in their private lives, quite independently of where they ended up with these treatments that I'm talking about, had been interested in martial arts and yoga and Tai Chi and Qigong and had found them very helpful. And but they had to keep them on the side. And it wasn't until the studies of Richard Davidson and Lazar of meditation showed that these people actually could control their nervous systems, which had been shown in yogis, by the way, in the 50s and 60s. And you could see the brain structure changing in active meditators. What I've done in this book is taken it a step further and gone and looked at aspects of I've looked at interventions that tend to go hand in hand with meditators. I mean, serious meditators in the East don't just meditate. They visualize. They use, you know, various traditions, different traditions use the energy systems of the body differently. And I have tried to see if there can be a bridge between Western neuroscience and these things, beyond, you know, the important initial bridges that have been formed in the meditation studies.
Talking to Norman Doidge, the author of The Brain That Changes Itself and his new book, The Brain's Way of Healing. If you enjoyed the first half of the show, please pass the information along to friends who would enjoy it, as well as liking us on iTunes. If you're just tuning back in, you can listen to the full program and check back to hear the first part, because the program will be featured in the Connect the Dots archives, and it'll be up later this afternoon. So we're resuming this conversation about brain neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to change, to heal itself, and what that reveals about a broader view of our true healing potential, and a broader view of how to look at human capacity through the lens of medical science. We're talking with Norman Doidge, MD, the author of The Brain's Way of Healing, his new book. In the last half of the show, you were saying that this is actually a further bridge from studies such as those done by Richard Davidson and others that show the effects of meditation, which is a kind of intended activity on human function, that he measured and found positive changes in responses to stress and, you know, healing activity as common and attainable by those who meditated regularly. And he actually studied brain patterns of meditation, I believe, too. I was mentioning that I'm interested very much in guided imagery because I know through having had on the show several times Belruth Napersteck, this is a kind of very easy way for people who may or may not have developed the skill in meditating to, you know, listen to imagery, picture things, and really recover. Both help the body heal in terms of recovery from surgery, as well as heal trauma and a whole bunch of other things. So this seems kind of in the same range, although, you know, your book talks about a very broad array of quite challenging physical, mechanical ailments that are also healed. So maybe we could, I'd love to hear your thoughts a little bit about guided imagery, and also about some of, you know, some examples of the kinds of things that this new understanding is helping people heal and helping practitioners heal as we learn how to work with brain plasticity.
Sure. Well, it's funny, you know, I came to guided imagery. Initially, I was fairly skeptical about it. It seemed to me that it was a lot of wishful thinking involved in guided imagery. I remember I was very typical of most people who were educated in the neuroscience model, which was basically very dualistic or Cartesian, meaning that we're made of two substances. One is mind. It operates by certain principles. The other is body, and it operates by the laws of the new physics. And, I mean, I don't want to underrepresent Descartes. I don't think he wrote everything he believed. There were very dangerous times for a philosopher, but without going into the details, for various reasons, most people took Descartes' position to be that we are made of these two different substances. And the one thing that the Cartesian theory couldn't explain was if they were both governed by different laws, how something as simple as raising your hand would work, because how would mental substance possibly influence physical substance? Mm-hmm. And so if you would hear somebody talking about guided imagery to deal with, boosting their immune system or something like that, or calming themselves down, it was very hard to understand how it worked. Well, we just have so many brain scans now that show the following kind of thing happening. When you think of, let's say, when you look at the letter A on a page, or you look at your friend, and then you close your eyes and imagine your friend, roughly the same coalition of neurons is activated when you look at your friend or when you close your eyes and imagine your friend or remember your friend. So in mental states, we really are getting at the same kinds of neurons and the same kinds of firing patterns as when we experience things. And the whole virtual reality world exploits this. And guided imagery as well, and it can be very sophisticated, and I'm not going to be doing it justice, but at the simplest level, involves making use of this. Mm-hmm. Now, hypnotists were using a lot of this 50, 100 years ago, and the students of Milton Erickson and other prominent hypnotists still make use of the power of just having imagery in the head to change your overall mental state. And how far it goes, we don't exactly know. But we certainly know that there's a number of things you can do with it. Now, let me just take one example of this. In Australia, there's a very, very creative neuroscientist named Lorimer Moseley. And okay, this is not quite guided imagery, but it'll give you a sense of the relationship of the visual and the pain system. He took people who had chronic hand pain and swollen hands, and he got them to look at their hands through some binoculars and through a regular lens that didn't magnify them, and then through reverse binoculars that kind of minimized or minified them.
Hmm.
And what he found with these, and he's a very, very good researcher, is when they looked at their hands through the binoculars to magnify them, their pain increased. And weirdly, so did their swelling.
Wow.
When he reversed the binoculars, their pain diminished. And so did their swelling. Now, he thinks that there are various cells in the brain that process input from both vision and touch that are together, and that might explain it. That's, very intelligent speculation. That may, in fact, be the case. And so that the magnified view, the magnified view triggers something in both systems. This visual. Did I say touch? I mean visual sort of spatial kinds of cells, rather. And the minimized view, et cetera, lowers input to these cells. That may be the case. But, these are the kinds of weird things that hypnotists would often report that people could do in trances. And, again, because it doesn't fit our normal model of dualism and mind and body are not, connected, they tend just to get written off.
Let me just ask one question there, which is, how would hypnotists report Like, what would they be reporting that would be similar to this? I'm trying to kind of grasp that.
Well, you know, some hypnotists would, I don't know, someone's got a throbbing headache, you know, and they might fiddle around with the person in the trance to get them, well, they might get them to imagine that they had a, or dealing with certain kinds of pain, that their foot was in a cold bucket of water.
Right.
Or something, and then, and soon they go numb and they can't feel the pain. They might do that for a person with chronic pain or various kinds of things. I mean, a typical hypnotic maneuver is to, if there's a person in a lot of distress, but the part of their body feels good, you gradually imagine growing, expanding that part of the body that feels good until it melts into the part that doesn't feel good. And again, all of this, people tended to assume that, well, people who are responding to these kinds of things are hysterical or wild or unstable emotionally, etc. But when you study these things, or people who have the placebo responses, but actual studies show that people who are placebo responders, are they don't correlate with being mentally ill or more unstable or any of the things they thought they correlated with. These are abilities that are available to a large number of people. I mean, another very similar and totally weird and interesting version of that Lorimer Moseley experiment was some academics in Nottingham, England, developed a kind of virtual reality machine where you would put your finger in it and it would distort the body image so that if you tugged on your finger, it looked like it was going longer or shorter. And it was sort of like a computer, like a funhouse mirror kind of effect with a computer. And so they wanted to show it, and the kids were playing with it. And then a grandmother of one of the children came by, thought it looked like fun, and said, "I want to have a go." And she started tugging on her hands, making them look thinner. And it so happened that she had arthritis in her fingers. And she said, "My finger doesn't hurt anymore," as she's looking at the change. But, you know, most of these are very interesting things, but most of the things I'm dealing with in the book have to do with helping people with MS, Parkinson's, autism, learning disorders, with various of these energy-based interventions or treatments that involve, you know, biological levels of electricity, light, and sound.
Can you give a few examples of some of those cases?
Sure. Well, let's talk about sound. I have seen cases of children with learning disorders and autism radically improved. I have one case of a child with autism who simply has no autism left anymore, and now he's 22. So our model of autism has been quite wrong. In some ways, parents sense this before physicians. It's best articulated by the neurologist from Harvard, Martha Herbert. Autism is a whole-body disease. It's not just a psychiatric disease. These children have high rates of inflammation throughout their bodies. In many cases, they have dermatitis. They have gastroenteritis at much higher rates. On autopsy, their brain shows signs of great inflammation. And their brains are also show signs with various kinds of complex scans of being underconnected in many areas and hyperconnected in others. So autistic children also show very high rates of hypersensitivity to sound. Now, most people don't know this, but everybody has inside their ear an auditory zoom. So that when you, it's like a zoom on a camera. When you walk into a room, there's booming, buzzing confusion, and slowly but surely you're able to focus in on one, you know, on human speech, one conversation about religion, another one about love, another about politics. That's your zoom working. Another thing about the zoom is this. The frequencies of human speech tend to be the higher frequencies, and lower frequencies in the course of evolution often represented predators. That's why when you go to a movie like Jaws or a scary movie, it's boom, 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 when the monster or the threat's coming on. Children with autism, for a variety of reasons having to do with the underconnectivity in the brain and possibly with some other children with developmental delays, have very lax muscles, don't have control of their auditory zoom. So they can't get into the realm of human speech, and they're often hearing these low predatory sounds, which sets their nervous system into fight or flight, causes them to cover their ears because they're in immense pain when certain machines, which are uninterrupted sounds that often have some very low, low sounds, assault them. Some people have argued that the essence of autism is the inability to perceive other minds. I think that that may not be the case. I think that some of that may be reactive. It may be a subgroup of autistic children can't perceive other minds, but that's because of this other problem in many cases. So what is it? Because they're in constant fight or flight, and they're underconnected so that they don't get any pleasure from human speech. So one of the interventions is a kind of listening therapy where we play higher and lower frequencies back and forth, gradually training them in increments that are tolerable to them to get control of the auditory zoom. We don't give it too much that it upsets them, but just enough to challenge them. And there's more to it than this. I'm giving you a simplified version. But as they get control of the auditory zoom, they're not covering their ears. They stop being in fight or flight. They start looking up to their mothers and spontaneously hugging them. These are kids who have basically been very withdrawn from autism and now become connected. And over time, with this intervention and various boosts, which I describe in the book, they can make really significant improvements. I've got, you know, one fellow that I describe who's, you know, was supposed to be institutionalized. And I'm not saying he's typical, because he was a case of a guy who was moderate to severe who went to no autism. He graduated honors in high school, went to university, has friends. You know, he's warm, he's witty, he's got great people skills. Nobody in the world would know what he was like. But if you go onto the website where he got treatment at the Listening Center, you can see what he was like as a kid. And he was just, you know, kicked out of school for biting people and out of control. A more common outcome is that someone might go from moderate autism to mild autism, but be engaged and be much more capable of being independent, have a friend or two, that kind of thing.
What about dementia or Alzheimer's, that kind of thing? Because
there's no example of a cure of dementia or Alzheimer's in my book, but there is a large chapter on degenerative disease and the role of exercise. There are examples of people with Parkinson's. I mean, I don't even think this is controversial now, but it was a couple of years ago. But there have been a couple of studies that have come out that show that Parkinson's, if you can keep up certain kinds of exercise, can at times be fended off. And I give an example of a man who actually, and this is not typical, but he did. He went off medication altogether with a special kind of walking. Now, a word about walking, and then I'll say why it relates to deferring dementia or fending it off. Two things happen when you walk from a brain point of view. Well, three. One, your heart is strengthened. But from a brain point of view, you produce neurotrophic growth factors, which are like kind of fertilizer that allow you to form and maintain new connections in the brain between brain cells. And you also form new brain cells. This was discovered in 1998 in a small part of the brain, which is very, very important, called the hippocampus, that turns short-term memories into long-term memories. Now, you might ask, why would walking trigger new cells and nerve growth factors in the brain? The man who discovered stem cells in the brain, Fred Gage, or co-discovered them, put forward this theory, which I find extremely compelling. when must an animal go on very long walks? When the environment it is in now becomes depleted of food or filled with predators, so that it's got to leave and go to a new place, which it doesn't know. It has to go into unexplored territory and explore it. And so it's going to have to do a lot of learning. And the secretion of these factors and the production of these new cells is a kind of anticipatory proliferation or readying the animal or person for new learning. Now, only 13 months ago, a study was published in Wales by an incredibly important research group. No one's found anything wrong with this study. And I'll explain it to you, and I'll tell you what it showed. They followed 2,300 men. It was practically every male in a community in Wales. It was, like, I think 89% of the entire male population. And they followed them for 30 years, doing five activities that 30 years ago were thought to be healthy. And they were exercise, basically walking 2 miles a day, and it was usually the man walked to work for a mile and walked home for a mile, or riding a bike for 10 miles, you know, it was 5 or 6 days a week, or regular vigorous exercise. That was number one. Number two, maintaining normal weight, BMI between 18 and 25. Number three, eating fruits, lots of fruits and vegetables, fortified portions, not smoking, and drinking only low amounts or moderate amounts of alcohol. So here's what that did. So you should put on your seatbelt. That lowered the risk of dementia, including Alzheimer's dementia, by 60%. Now, if any drug lowered the risk of Alzheimer's dementia by 60%, it would be the most talked about drug on the planet. But many people have not heard about this study. It also lowered the risk of diabetes, no surprise, vascular disease, stroke, heart attack, and premature death by all causes.
This is all the standard, take care of your health platform.
Yeah, it's all the things we've been told, but here it was demonstrated, and it's all the things that a lot of people don't do.
Wow.
But you have to do 4 to 5 of those things. But I just want to tell you about this group because isn't it interesting that a lot of people haven't heard of this study?
Really?
So in medicine, the pioneer of systematic randomized control trials and just evaluating studies very carefully was a man named Archibald Cochrane. And they set up these things called Cochrane Reviews, and pretty much every doctor knows about the Cochrane Review. You know, if they don't know about a treatment, they'll say, well, what does the Cochrane Review say? And they tend to evaluate studies for their quality and then clump them together and see what the likely strength of the finding is. So Archibald Cochrane actually helped to design this whale study, and it was led by Peter Elwood, who succeeded Cochrane and works at the Cochrane Institute. I mean, this is really an impeccable research group. But it's showing something outside of everyone's expectations, which is that the help for things like Alzheimer's and dementia, et cetera, is going to clearly come from some very high-tech venture that we've spent billions of dollars on. If you think about this, because I'm mindful of your audience's interests, all of these things I would say to you are what Nassim Taleb called subtractive interventions. Or what I would just say is the following. All of them involve living closer to the nature, the system in which we evolved to live. I mean, doing this kind of exercise, like, you know, regular walking, it's basically subtractive. It's not taking the car. It's not using a machine to get you around. So it's bringing you closer to nature. If you look at, you know, indigenous peoples, they're, you know, all pretty slim. They don't eat things that come out of packages. They eat lots of fruits and vegetables, and occasionally they have meat. And I know there's some variation, but The people in this weren't told to never eat meat. It's just that they had to eat fruits and vegetables. And I think they were the presence of fruits and vegetables in their diet was a stand-in for a more natural diet. Mm-hmm. Smoking was an invention, and alcohol was an invention. Now, alcohol is a really old invention, but it's still an invention. So it's all about living closer to our nature. Now, I think that there are probably things that can be done to improve, that still leaves 40% of people who weren't helped. But I think there are other issues here that, people interested in integrative medicine can anticipate that may also be doing some of the predisposing to dementia. I mean, and that probably, to my mind, includes toxins.
Yes.
And head injuries. The recent studies of the NFL players, I mean, obviously they get unbelievable amounts of head injuries and shakeups, but head injuries, we know, predispose to, things like Parkinson's and all sorts of brain-like problems. And, in the football players, we can see head injuries causing premature dementia. So I think that some sensible things and some sensible precautions can probably improve on that 60%. And it's not all the way there, and it may, and there are some dementias that seem to be very heavily genetic. And, about 5% in my reading of the literature are very heavily genetic.
Mm-hmm.
But the overwhelming majority of dementias, even environment is a crucial component. And not only that, but you can even have some of the genes that are affiliated with Alzheimer's, for instance.
Oh, we're getting our concluding music here coming up. So
and not get Alzheimer's.
That's very interesting. I just actually got an email that there's going to be another look at the mercury amalgams in dentistry, because they're, we call it environmental, but it's a, it's a heavy metal coming into people's mouths. And
by the way, just a couple of inches from, your back teeth.
Right.
Are about an inch and a half away from your brainstem.
Right. And, they're just trying to kind of tackle that one I just heard about. So when we call things, some of these toxins that we bring in, and certainly that isn't as natural as walking around your neighborhood and eating basic foods. Thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. We've kind of gone far afield here, but it's been totally wonderful. Thank you so much, Norman.
Thank
Deutsch,
you.
For being with us. This is a fabulous and a very informative conversation. Listeners, check out his book, The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. There's a lot more to who we are and what we can do to heal. Also, check out his earlier book, The Brain That Changes Itself. Thank you for being with us this week on Connect the Dots. Oh, we'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great and healthy week.